Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Break the Cycle with me, your host, Joshua Smith. I hope everyone's having a wonderful Wednesday night. We're on episode 69, so get those nices going in the chat. I know you guys are going to get them, so we might as well get them out of the way now. We have a very exciting show for you tonight. I'm very excited. I hope everyone is excited as I am, but let's start off with some sponsors. As per the usual, we have Lorenzotti.coffee for all your delicious Italian coffee needs. Delivered directly to your door. Bring the taste of Italy home. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. And of course, my friend, my partner on the show, the coolest guy you know, toplobster.com for all your wonderful graphic design needs, where you can get this great Disobey Your Local Tyrant shirt that you see me wearing today with the crime boss Cuomo on it. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount, or join the Patreon, Subscribestar, or the channel membership here for YouTube to get into a private Discord server that you can get new Top Lobster designs up to 3 weeks early, 2 weeks early at like a 30% discount. So we're talking super deep discount, really cheap shirts. If you're one of the lower tiered members of the show, it actually really pays for itself if you're buying Top Lobster gear. And of course, executive producers of the show, anthemplanning.com, for all your emergency and crisis planning needs. Find out what these people can do for your business, home, or personal life. They're doing a wonderful job that the government has historically sucked at, much cheaper and much more efficiently.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
I think I messed up the audio, so we're going to have to let him catch up. I muted my mic instead of unmuting you because I produced the whole show myself, man. But hey, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. People are going to be dropping audio in the chat for a while, but I fixed it. It's okay. You guys are just on a lag. Barrett, why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey? I like to start off with a journey that people took, how you came to this Austrian economics, entrepreneurship kind of life. I mean, that's really what your life has become, right? I mean, you teach it, you give speeches about it. How did you get there?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty long story. So how much time do we have?
A while.
I mean, I started out in politics, really, back in my native country, Sweden, throughout the 90s, I was involved in politics as sort of a conservative free market type. And then when I was in college in the mid-90s, I was recommended by my university to do at least a couple of semesters abroad. And being a good student, I applied for universities in California, Hawaii, and Australia because I wanted to go to the beach.
Good thing you didn't end up in Australia, huh?
Yeah, well, right. Had it been now, then I would have, I would have still been there. But I ended up in Honolulu, and I got a couple of courses with a professor there, Ken Schooland, who really pushed me on the free market stuff, and pushed me over the edge. And after that, I mean, I learned more about my principles and applying the non-aggression principle. And I was sort of desperate to figure out how to get rid of the state because I understood that, the state has to go. I mean, if you believe in non-aggression, you can't have a state, but how the heck would it work? And I think a lot of people get stuck there. And I remember that I found the solution and a solution, in a way, through David Friedman's The Machinery of Freedom. And that was the fall of 98. And I remember that because I became an anarchist and I was elected for office at the very same time, which is sort of a little odd. But after that, I mean, I was working as a systems developer in Sweden, and I was writing like crazy. I think that one of those years in the early 2000s, I published something like 200 essays on different libertarian websites. So that's a little too many, I think. I mean, looking back at it, but there was a lot, right? And then my wife pretty much told me that, hey, you're miserable in your work, so why don't you just quit and go into academia instead? Because that's what you do. You just read and write anyway. So do that stuff instead. And, well, I did what she told me to, pretty much, and I applied for different PhD programs, and I didn't get into any in Sweden. And I, through the Mises Institute, I sent my CV to the Mises Institute, and the day after I get an email from Peter Klein at the University of Missouri saying, hey, how about Missouri? So that's how I ended up in agricultural economics, because that's where he was. And he was interested in the theory of the firm, in transaction costs and entrepreneurship. And there was a small group of professors there doing entrepreneurship stuff. So I ended up doing that too, and got really interested in that sort of thing while I was studying Austrian economics on the side and doing lots of events and then things, participating in those with Mises Institute. And then I happened to get a job as an adjunct teaching entrepreneurship and then a research job in entrepreneurship. And well, here I am now as a professor of entrepreneurship. So as I told you, it's not at all a straight line and sort of a long story.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you've done a lot, and that's a lot of papers to write, Per.
I know. I tried to collect them all on my website at some point, but I just stopped because I couldn't keep track of my own papers, pretty much.
That's wild, man. Absolutely wild. We got a super chat from Almighty Beej already, $20 super chat. Thank you, sir. He said, could you please expand on your thoughts of agorism and how it's not an economic analysis, but a political analysis? That's a pretty good question. We got a lot of agorists that watch the show.
Okay, cool. So how is it? Well, I mean, in the sense it applies economic theory. So it is really focused on entrepreneurship and how entrepreneurship creates things and how free exchange is beneficial for both parties, of course, unless there is a third party that robs them, right, or forces them to go ahead with the exchange. So it's not an economic theory. An economic theory would explain how the economy works or how the market functions, things like that. Agorism would be a theory for, or a strategy more, of how to use the economy the way we understand it as free market economists and use it to cause change. Basically, we do what we preach. Sure. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, absolutely. My friend David Hines asked, what did the Austrians have to say about the entrepreneur before, and are there new insights into the role entrepreneurs play in the economy? That's something that should be right up your alley, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Austrians have always prided themselves with having a theory of the entrepreneur and placing the entrepreneur at the center. And Mises is quoted as saying the entrepreneur is the driving force of the market economy and things like that. And it was already in Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, back in 1871. He had a page talking about the entrepreneur and what entrepreneurs do and that sort of thing. So it's always been there, but I mean, it hasn't really been fleshed out. So the details are not really there. The connection to economic growth is not really there. I mean, until recently, there was not really a theory of the firm. What the heck does the firm do? And what is it, economically speaking? We didn't quite have a grasp of that either. And Kirzner came along in 1973 and wrote a book on entrepreneurship where he took sort of a thin slice of Mises' stuff and elaborated on that part. But that's sort of a part that Mises in Human Action also says is not very important. So it's an easy type of entrepreneurship that you can theorize easily about, but it doesn't explain a whole lot about the real world. And Austrians have sort of after that continued to develop Kirzner's theory and continue to figure out what entrepreneurs do in the marketplace. And I've done that myself. And I've connected it with economic growth through the firm and value creation and that sort of thing. Sort of less macro and business cycle theory and things like that, and more what the heck do they do? Like, how do you create value in the economy?
Sure, yeah. And so I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not very smart, Per, right? I do a show. I have a lot of smart people on. This is how we build the show with smart people, but... For some of my fans that might not understand, I'm sure most do, but I mean, how do you go about explaining, you know, Austrian economics to like the layman person? I mean, how do you do it without throwing Human Action at him and being like, read this, you know, the book's this thick. So, I just wonder how you would do it.
Yeah. And that is a problem because we don't really have any, at least I don't think we have any very good introductions. And explaining everything about Austrian economics, how it's different. In a sense, it's sort of the continuation of old style economics from the 19th century. In another sense, it's sort of radical view, and it has its own methodology and all this stuff. So, I mean, I'm working on a primer on Austrian economics that is we are expecting it to be published. Well, I guess the Mises Institute is expecting it to be published anyway in December. And the point of that is to do exactly what you said. How do you explain Austrian economics to a newbie, pretty much, or someone who's not completely an idiot, but someone who also doesn't know economics and just wonders what is Austrian economics and what is economics about, that sort of thing. So it gives you basic economic literacy, and that's what I'm trying to do in that book. Go through in a very short format. Go through what economics does.
Sure, and is that your fourth book?
That's gonna be my third book.
Third book. Okay, awesome. And how far along are you on there?
Well, never ask an author how far along he is in a book. It's pretty much like asking a PhD or master's student, how's the thesis going?
Oh, Jesus.
They're not going to like that. But I'm working on it, and I the ideas are sort of clear in my mind, and I have the structure done and all this stuff, and I just need to... I'm struggling with finding the right tone, because I need to channel my inner Henry Hazlitt, in a sense.
Sure.
It needs to be really simple, to the point, yet still informative.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a more digestible economics book than Economics and One Less. I don't know. Do you know if there's a more digestible book than that one for people?
I don't think there is, and that's sort of why I'm aiming for that type of format. But we want it to be much shorter. So I tried to cover not only his book is really one lesson.
Yeah.
It is that there's a trade-off and there's opportunity cost. That's pretty much the whole book. And what I'm trying to do is cover all of Austrian economics to the extent possible in half the length. So that's why I'm struggling a little bit with the tone, because I can't really go into details and I can't really explain specifics. So I have to rush through it a little bit, but still make it intuitive to the reader.
Sure. Yeah. It's a very in-depth economic ideology. I mean, really, it's pretty wild to think about how extensively some people like Murray Rothbard and Hoppe and Mises and all these people have written about it, and then think about how to explain that to people. You know, my mother, for example, she would consider herself like a libertarian, kind of, but it's like, how do I explain all of this stuff to her, you know, from Human Action in like 10 minutes, digestible. So that's really cool that you're doing that. I'm sure that tons of people will appreciate that. But so what do you think is more important for Austrian economics economists today, further developing the field, or trying to find new ways to appeal to lay people? I mean, it's been so developed. I mean, is there still like a penchant for that at all?
Yeah, there's plenty to do still, I think. And I think we sort of need both. And we need both sort of evangelists that are spreading the word and taking it out there, and we need people who have developed the theory too. And there are some really good projects in getting the theory and getting this type of really deep understanding for how the market economy works out there. And from my perspective, the obvious way to do that is to talk to entrepreneurs and business owners. And why? Well, simply because they are Austrians. And I say this quite often, that an experienced entrepreneur or business owner, they are Austrians already. It's just that they don't know it and they don't have the terminology and that sort of thing, but they've seen how the market works and they've seen what sort of strategies work and what sort of strategies do not work and why. So they sort of have this tacit knowledge or understanding of the market economy. And that's what Austrians have too. Austrians don't really go into predictions and math and that sort of thing, but we have the understanding and we know what is going on. And talking to business leaders, businessmen, entrepreneurs, and so forth, giving them the tools, in a sense, to avoid mistakes is a very powerful way to spread the message, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody wants to know, how do you think that the development of artificial intelligence fits into Austrian theory? Can robots replace workers or even entrepreneurs? Could we have a robot Jeff Bezos? Is that, I mean, where does that fall into the Austrian theory?
Are you saying Jeff Bezos is not a robot?
I thought he was a lizard. I don't know. He could, you know, he could okay. be a robot too.
Yeah, I think it fits perfectly, really, in the theory that AI is like any other software in a sense. I mean, you can use it productively and use it in production. And of course, AI can potentially develop machines and so forth and relieve us of work. I mean, some would call it to make us unemployed, but I don't think that is actually going to happen to a huge extent. Instead, what they're going to do is just what machines have done so far. It has saved us from dangerous work, as it saved us from hard manual labor, and instead provided us with shorter work days, better pay, and also we can rely to much greater extent on what our true quality is. And it's right up here. It's our ingenuity as human beings and our ability to imagine things and imagine solutions. And I don't think an artificial intelligence can do that. What it can do is calculate stuff really quickly. So if we feed an artificial intelligence with physics and biology and whatever knowledge we have accumulated, they can produce machines and they can figure out how to produce faster computers or whatever. But those are not going to replace us, because the whole economy is about satisfying people on people's own terms. And an AI can't figure that out unless that AI becomes human, but then it's not really an AI anymore.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Level Zero for the $5 super chat. He said, Pear is one of the best follows on Twitter. He loves your snark. And that's not the Nicholas Sarwark snark. This is like the good kind of snark we're talking about here. Almighty Beach gave a $5 shout out. Thank you. He said, where do you fall on the free versus freed market debate of not using the dirty word of capitalism?
I fall on the don't use it in that camp. And it's pretty easy, because it seems that everybody has their own version of the term. And there's always this, talking to leftists, it's always the case that they will say something about capitalism, and then we or our side or whatever will push back that that's not what capitalism is. And then it's all about the word. And we don't understand what they're saying, and they don't understand what we're saying. And they just assume that, a free market needs private property, and private property is impossible without a state. That's their assumption. So that's how they get to cronyism directly from private property, because the state is already there. And we can't really talk to them on those terms, because first of all, that's not true, right? You can't have private property without the state. And if you can, then we can talk to them about the free market, how the free market actually functions, and that it is what they talked about in the 1800s, that it is more or less like an economic organism. It's not really a system, and it's definitely not the sort of the economics gang sign, you know, the supply and demand like this.
Right.
I think we need to lose the term, and it wasn't ours to begin with. So there are other terms that the left stole from us, like liberal, but capitalism wasn't our terms to begin with, and its purpose and the intent is really to point to capital in the Marxian sense, that it's capital versus workers. And if that is a starting point, I mean, how can we even debate with them? Because if that is the assumption, that we have already lost. So it's better to talk about free markets in sort of the individualist anarchist sense, with Benjamin Tucker and Lysander Spooner and those guys. And they were talking about, they call themselves socialists, but free market socialists. And why? Because they understood how the economy works. And that's where we need to get the leftists.
Yeah, they're kind of like a market anarchist today, or whatever you want to call it. Correct. This is a really good conversation. I actually really like this, because, I traveled around the country for 4 years and tried to get people to see libertarianism as the way. I actually sit on the Libertarian National Committee, which is funny. You were bringing up Ken Skolin, who's part of the Libertarian Party in Hawaii and stuff like that too. That's pretty cool. But something that I talked with Larry Sharp about a lot was how terms can shut down a conversation immediately. And like free market, saying free market to a leftist is a death knell for a conversation. And so he started talking about, you know, calling it consumer driven, you know, say consumer driven market. It's a better way to frame that. It doesn't shut down the conversation. Leftists will keep going. And I started coming around to like, who gives a shit about the terms? when we could start, you know, creating understanding of our stuff. And it doesn't matter what terms we're using at all. You know, I can't tell somebody anarcho-capitalism anymore. It shuts down every debate with all kinds of people, not just anarcho-capitalists and anarcho-socialists or whatever you want to call them, but everybody. I mean, everybody. You're like, I'm an anarcho-capitalist. They're like, okay, cool. See you. Have a nice day. You know, enjoy your fedora. And it's like, man, but some of the greatest thinkers I've ever, you know, read are anarcho-capitalists or self-described anarcho-capitalists. But I mean, is there any other terms that you think are that we use as libertarians that maybe we should start thinking about changing?
Well, I mean, you mentioned a few already. In a sense, all the core terms, I mean, how we express ourselves is very important to not, maybe not just signal or be in people's faces. And free market is I like that term a lot. If I would talk to a leftist, I would say freed market instead, because that would mean that they would see, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? Right. So they would open for a conversation, because if you watch the news or whatever, they're going to talk about the free market. But the free market is basically what Mitch McConnell is for. Now, that's not what I mean when I say free market. So if that is the assumption that the person has that whom I'm talking to, then it's going to be really, really hard to first describe to them that no, I don't mean that what you mean when you use the same term. And that's a side issue. That's a discussion we don't have time to have. I mean, we should focus on the concepts. We should focus on what works. We should focus on how the economy works.
Sure. Yeah.
And in a sense, we should probably call it society instead. I mean, I think Mises wanted to call human action sociology or something like that first, or praxeology, sociology. And why? Well, because it is social. It is to Mises and to many of us Austrians, the economy and society, you can't really separate the two. And society arises out of the division of labor and specialization and working together by specializing and trading. So that is the sort of social connection in the economy. And if you realize that, then you can't separate society and economy as most people do.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a theory of human action and humans interact with each other all the time in all kinds of different
exactly.
ways.
And sometimes it's with money, sometimes it's with goods, and sometimes it's not.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Top Lobster, thanks for the $5 super chat. He says, Pierre's correct. The former face of Papa John was just on Tim Pool talking economics that reminded me of Bob Murphy. What? I don't get it. Bubblegum Gun, $2 super chat. He said, market socialism is just a commie admitting defeat. You think that's true?
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, that would be the short answer. I think so. Because a market socialism, if you go back to the people who used it first back in the 30s, I mean, what they said was that, well, we recognize how the market works, and the market works through prices and trade and all this stuff, but the government should still own everything. And they made up all these schemes for how you could have the qualities from the market yet still have the beautiful government owning everything, which is, in a sense, taking a big step back from Marx. So it is a defeat in a sense.
Sure. So something that I'm really interested in, and I, you know, this is, it's like a conversation I've had repeatedly over and over and over again. You know, whenever I talk about, you know, economics with either normal people or social democrats or whatever they want to call themselves these days, they always point to the Nordic countries, right? I mean, or the Nordic model of democratic socialism, and you being from Sweden, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, how do we really combat that when they start talking about, you know, those places and their economies and how everybody's so happy and, you know, this and that. And then, but for me, it's like, I look up the anti-depression medication use. It's like double, you know what I mean, per capita. And so it kind of does make me wonder, but how do we combat that when we're talking to, you know, the normal everyday American?
Well, one thing would be to simply tell them the truth about Sweden and what is going on. I mean, Sweden, yeah, it had a huge welfare state, especially when I grew up. It was huge and everybody thought it was awesome. But I mean, in a sense, the Swedish welfare state, it adopted really radical socialist principles in about 1970. And in 1992, it imploded completely. And after that, the state has sort of retreated. And they've cut down on social welfare spending and policies like that. And today it's very different. Of course, now Sweden is doing better. So now the socialists are pushing for more welfare systems again. So it's always going back and forth. But Sweden is really, if you look at economic freedom indexes and things like that, Sweden is very high on those. And it's not because they have a welfare system. It's because taxes on businesses are pretty low. Businesses are not that regulated, comparatively speaking. Sweden has really, really high taxes, but it's almost exclusively on labor. It's not on business. So there's a lot of I mean, Sweden's success is really a free market story. If you go back in time, from 1870 through 1970, it was about deregulating, stripping the king of powers, and free market policies, and that's what caused Sweden to go from Europe's poorest to the world's fourth richest in 100 years.
Wow, I didn't even realize they were the fourth richest. That's pretty wild. And they did that all in 100 years.
Yeah. But that was in 1970. I mean, then you just feed the welfare state and let it balloon, and then, well, then it takes 22 years to implode.
Sure. It's just a constant cycle. I mean, we see it happen pretty much everywhere, right? But what do they say? The bad times make hard men create good times. And it's just, it's a circle, right? Constant circle. And
right, yeah.
So somebody brought it up on my Twitter the other day about your talk at Mises U recently, and talking about separating libertarianism from, was it from anarcho-capitalism? Is that what you were talking about? Or Austrian economics, splitting it from mm-hmm. the term libertarian. Can you expand on that more and tell us why you think that?
Sure. That was really I answered a question from one of the students in the audience. And the point is really that Austrian economics is a positive theory. It's a in a sense a science or scholarship trying to understand how the economy works. And yes, it has a theory for the free market, but that's necessary in order to identify what regulations do to the economy. You can't really compare and say, oh, this regulation has this effect, unless you also know what it would be like without that effect. So you have to start with free market economy, and then you introduce the state and you introduce all these things theoretically. So there's really nothing ideological or normative in Austrian economics. Austrian economics just describes it the way it is and provides you with understanding for how the economy works. That's it. But of course, if you have a very good understanding for how the economy works and how the market works, there's basically no way that you can be a socialist. Because you realize that the power of the wealth creation in the marketplace, and you realize that, wait a minute, all these voluntary transactions are definitely not, they're just, right? They're not unjust. So you have to have a very wicked, weird morality to take the step from knowing Austrian economics and knowing that it is true and saying that, oh, well, we need someone to meddle with this beautiful system. And libertarianism, of course, is about values. It's about having a goal for society and for yourself. It's not really about science. So it's different in that sense. They often go together simply because the free market and libertarianism, they go together. And Austrian economics is the best explanation for how the free market works.
Hi, kids. Do you like violence?
Yeah. Are you sick to death of pussyfooting around the truth while being constantly fed lies by news and big tech tyrants? If so, then come join me, Dan Smotz, on The System Is Down, where we get weird, have fun, and dig into all the dangerous taboo topics like conspiracies, politics, religion, culture, current events, and everything your family just prays you don't bring up around the Thanksgiving dinner table. And I know that reality is scary to some people, so if you're easily offended, just ignore this and go back to making cat memes or whatever. But if you're ready to change the world for the better, come join me on The System Is Down at tsidpod.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's tsidpod.com, because the system is down and truth is taking over.
Sure, absolutely. Almighty Beach gave a $2 super chat. He's asked, do you like Eskimo Joes? I don't know what that is. Do you know what that is?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. It's like a restaurant on the other side of the street from campus at Oklahoma State. It's one of those student places. I think it's fine, I guess. It's not fancy food. It's not great food. It's a good student hangout.
It's all right to hang out. It's a cool place to chill. Drywall O sent a $5 super chat. He said, are we the owner of land or our bodies if we pay to use? I don't know. Is that, that doesn't, I think you got to clarify that a little bit more, Drywall. I appreciate you, man. Let's talk a little bit about entrepreneurship. So obviously this is your bread and butter, you know, on top of Austrian economics, but why entrepreneurship? Why should people become entrepreneurs?
Oh, that's easy. I mean, and very hard. So, it's easy because that's a way of creating things. That's a way of being who you are. It's a way of working the way you want to work and be your own boss and all this stuff. It's also easy because it is a way of creating our tomorrow, because that's how I usually describe what entrepreneurs do. They create new things and they hope that consumers in the future will like those things. So to be innovative is really to create our tomorrows. You're changing the world. You're changing people's realities and people's everyday lives by creating new goods and services. So, I mean, and those are, I mean, very positive aspects of being an entrepreneur. And of course, you can have many different reasons for doing this. And if you don't want to bear the uncertainty, if you don't want to take the risk, then you should probably get a job somewhere else. And basically what you're doing is it's sort of free riding on the entrepreneur that started the whole thing. And you get a salary and all this stuff. But I think it's important that we realize that entrepreneurs are really the force that is pushing the market forward. They're creating what's going to be tomorrow. And we see all these huge corporations and think that they're so powerful. And the left would keep reminding us that they're so big and they have so much money, that they have so much power. There's no one who could ever deal with these huge corporations. But all it takes is really one guy with a new type of product. And then everybody will just change their behavior and they will just abandon the big corporation because they're not interested anymore in that product. So they only have power as long as consumers give it to them. And entrepreneurs are in the business of recreating and renewing our world. And I think all the solutions to basically all of our problems economically and politically, they're in entrepreneurship.
Nice. And that's just through innovation, you think? Is that that's the answer to a lot of our problems?
Yeah, it is in a technical sense, by which I mean that there's a difference between invention and innovation. So invention would be the idea for some new gadget or some new technology. Innovation is bringing it to market and making it valuable to consumers. So you can have innovation by providing a product that already exists and is provided by a number of companies already, but you do it in a different way that is much more appealing to consumers, and then they will pick you. And this new way of offering it to them is the innovation, right? So it can be a different way of paying for stuff, like going from CDs to listening to streamed music. That's not really a technology thing. It changed our behavior because now we don't buy CDs and then we have our CDs and we play only those. Instead, we listen to things whenever we feel like it and we pay a subscription fee every month. That's a very different way of thinking about it. That's a very different way of discovering music too. So our behavior changed completely, even though the music is the same music.
Sure, absolutely. Somebody asked a question. What is malinvestment and why isn't it an important concept? Is that something you're familiar with? I don't know much. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know much about entrepreneurship. I've always had a boss, except for a very brief amount of time when I was, you know, put out some Craigslist ads and did a bunch of side work. I've worked in trade work my whole life. So entrepreneurship is something that's always intrigued me, something I've always wanted to be a part of, something I'm kind of doing with the show. But I just
going to say, you're doing it right now. So yeah. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but I don't know much about, you know, the driving force behind it and all that stuff. So when I hear malinvestment, it just sounds like a bad investment to me. I don't know.
In a sense, it is. But what it refers to is the Austrian business cycle theory. So why do we have these booms that turn into busts in the economy overall? And the malinvestment is really that we have investments where consumers did not actually ask for them. So we have overinvestment in some sectors and we have underinvestment in some sectors. So the whole, in a sense, the whole economic structure is out of whack, which is usually because the banking system or the central bank, they have created a lot of credit. And that ends up somewhere, and that increases the purchasing power in some industry at the expense of other industries. And then the whole economy starts to produce things that are not really in line with what consumers want.
Sure. So you teach people entrepreneurship. That's what you do in Oklahoma. And I mean, what do you guys cover when you're talking about, like, you know, the importance of entrepreneur? I mean, what kind of stuff do you guys go over? It's not like economics class, right?
No, it's not. And that's really a shame, because we should really teach them more about how the economy works. And I do that in my courses, and I've developed a few that are, well, special courses, I guess you could call it. The standard course would be just to put together a business plan and then force the students to think through all the steps and expose their ideas to potential customers and so forth, and calculate whether there is a profit opportunity or not, and all this sort of practical stuff. So we teach that, but when you get to like graduate level, we start teaching theories on who are entrepreneurs, who are typically not entrepreneurs, and then what kind of psyche do entrepreneurs have. I think those are pretty uninteresting, but that's part of the theory, and that's what we teach. I mean, in my case, I teach one course on Austrian economics, so there's entrepreneurship in there. Right. And I teach one course on that's called Entrepreneurship and Society, which is really connecting entrepreneurship with the regulatory apparatus. So what is the effect of government on entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship? Of course, we know it's a negative effect, but it's a little more than that. So it affects in certain ways and how how do you deal with, how do you think about these things?
Nice. So I got some more questions from a bunch of, so many people have questions for you, Pear. You're very, very popular. Usually when I ask if people have questions for my guests, they're like, is a taco a sandwich? It's always something stupid. Not for you though. They know you're a smart guy. That's what it is. But we did have the, Tom Woods and I had the, is the hot dog a sandwich debate in our exclusive stream after the regular stream. It was a lot of fun. And he had a very solid, argument in favor of it being a sandwich. So, or in favor
I'm
of
sure.
it not.
I'm sure. Tom is a smart guy and it's fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. What are your thoughts on theories like search costs? Where do they fit in economics, broadly speaking?
Search costs. Well, I mean, they fit in like any other kind of cost, really. So if there's a high cost for searching, I mean, then you would probably, to a great extent, avoid doing that sort of activity. So any cost is, I think about it in the sense of entrepreneurs going for value and managers avoiding costs. And if you're going for value, then the search itself is, if it's costly and you realize that it's costly, that you can't really figure out the value because that's going to cost you a lot and it takes too much time or whatever, you should probably stay away from it. If you're a manager, search cost is not a huge problem really, because you're already in a business that already exists. The opportunity has already been discovered, as we call it. Yeah, you have minor search costs for like new employees and new suppliers maybe and things like that. But it's I've written some articles on transaction costs, which is sort of similar. It's a broader concept, and it's become one of those things in academia where they get thrown in everywhere and people think they explain everything. And my articles have basically just said that. No, they don't.
Fair. Hey, you know, if you're going to say, you might as well be the broad, you know, then it's hard to question something that broad, right? Almighty Beach, thanks for the $5 super chat. Man, you're just killing tonight. He said, your book, The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized is phenomenal. I think that you put that one out.
How long, thank you.
How long has that one been out? That one's been out a long time now.
5 years.
5 years, yeah. Absolutely.
But I think it's just starting to get recognized right now. And I think the ideas are really important, and it's sort of a precursor of the primer, because it explains the whole economy in a sort of simple way and goes step by step to show how it gets more complex, and then what the effect of regulations are on entrepreneurs and the economy, and how it takes people's opportunities away. You get all those choices that you have; they're wonderful, but without regulations, you would have so many more choices.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a good super chat. Bubblegum Gun. He asks if you believe in copyrights. We've had so many conversations about copyright and intellectual property on the show, because I had Ron Coleman on, who was a trademark lawyer. They had Stephen Kinsella on, who's obviously a big IP against IP advocate. Where do you stand on that kind of stuff, man? Especially being an entrepreneur guy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely recognize that they exist. And to any entrepreneur starting a business right now, I would definitely tell them to seek a patent and use the system, get a copyright and everything like that. If you ask me about the effect on the economy and where I stand personally, then I'm totally opposed to them, because those are privileges imposed on the economy and given by the state to some people. And it, from my entrepreneurship perspective, which is a little different than Stefan's, the problem here is that they mix up what we talked about before, invention versus innovation. They think that patents protect the invention, but the invention doesn't really matter all that much. It, of course, we need ideas, but the, it's the innovation that matters. It's the bringing it to market and making it valuable to consumers. Well, that can be based on the same idea. So if you protect and give a privilege to the idea itself and whoever has the idea, then you're going to stifle really the true innovation, really bringing it to consumers and making it valuable. So it's a great way of destroying the economy in a sense.
Sure. Have you spent any time with Hans Hermann Hoppe?
Have I spent time with him? I've met him several times, but I haven't really spent much time.
Okay,
with
I was wondering, because everybody that's worked at Mises that I've had on the show always has some kind of funny story about Hoppe, so I just was wondering if you had one too. But if you don't spend a lot of time with him, I can understand how you don't. But so who are some of your favorite? I mean, do you have favorite economists who are not Austrians? Is there anybody that influenced you that wasn't an Austrian economist?
Sure. Can I mention dead people?
Sure, absolutely. It doesn't have to be living. That's totally fine.
really
some of the greatest Austrian economists are dead too. So it's it's how it works.
Yeah, true. But I would go back to proto-Austrians, as they're called, like Cantillon and others, or Cantillon, or however you pronounce his name. Back in he wrote an economics treatise like 50 years before Adam Smith, and which is pretty awesome considering when he wrote it and what he put in it. The French liberal school with Jean-Baptiste Say and others. Who else? I like others. I mean, I like contemporary economists too for stuff that they have done, but they're so narrowly specialized. I mean, back in the day, and Austrians still, they wrote treatises. They were like, here's my really thick book on the whole economy.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that is fascinating. And I sort of started, I had a New Year's resolution where I was like, I was going to read all the big treatises from basically economics day one through the year 1900.
Oof.
I'm still working on it.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I think it's fascinating, but it's also some of these treatises are a little dry and they focus on things that we don't think are very important anymore.
Yeah, I read Wealth of Nations. I get it. I know how it goes. I tried to get through it twice.
And when he goes through like 70 pages talking about historic corn prices or something, you go, what the hell, man? Drop it.
Yeah, definitely. Not a lot of brevity going on in the economist corner for sure. Wiggle77, thanks for the $5 super chat. This is great. He actually lives in Oklahoma. He said, Pear, do you have any advice for how the OKLP can help spread Austrian economics in Oklahoma? And Josh, start an OnlyFans, give the people what they want. Not going to happen. Thank you, though. That's the kind of entrepreneurship I shouldn't be doing until I'm broke. But the libertarians there, a lot of them are Mises Caucus people. Are you familiar with the Mises Caucus now? I was around when it was nothing. There was 50 of us in a group on Facebook, and now it's taking over the whole Libertarian Party, which is great because that's going to have a bigger focus on Austrian economics and use that political platform to push that stuff. But how can the libertarians do that in this country from that political platform? What do you think the best way to go about that is?
I wish I knew. I mean, for me, it's setting examples. So it's basically agorism. But that's not really what a political party should do. I think talking to students and so forth, I mean, it's really short videos. It's being out there, but not being out there in the sense of handing out flyers or anything like that, but being out there in social media and so forth. And I mean, I struggle with marketing my own courses to students. How do I reach students? I have no freaking clue. I've tried so many years to get like a lot of people enrolled in my courses, but it's hard. because they tend to follow what others are doing, and they are advised by people and all this stuff. So it's really hard, but you need to show them rather than tell them. I guess that's the basic idea.
And that's probably the hardest thing to do with any kind of economics. I mean, it's funny because the economists that are always so successful, you know, especially nationally here, they always seem to be the, hey, we'll give you stuff, economists, right? And then Austrians are like, hey, we'll let you keep your own stuff, right? And so the Libertarian Party's kind of, you know, we know, at least as far as I'm concerned, I'm the Murray Rothbard wing of the Libertarian Party. Murray Rothbard's who brought me to the ideas that I cherish today. He was a great writer. He kept you entertained, which was important. And I think that was what kind of helped me open the window. And now I've tried to understand human action more, and Hoppe, and I'm starting to read a lot more books. But it was Rothbard that really got me there. And he was one of the founders of the Libertarian Party, and he called the Libertarian Party the libertarian wing of, or the political wing of the liberty movement. But it is hard to teach economics through a political party. I think it's really, really, it's one of the most challenging things to do.
Yeah, it is. But on the other hand, I mean, if you talk, like we said before, if you talk to business owners, businessmen, and entrepreneurs, they sort of know it already. They get it, but they don't have the terminology to tell you. But they understand what you're saying. And I think for a political party, I think the median voter theorem that you need to talk to everybody and you need to attract everybody. I think more like Albert J. Nock with there is. A bunch of people out there who are looking for radical change, and they want to hear someone say it, and they might already have those ideas, but all those crooks in DC, you can't really trust any of them. So, I mean, holding back on those things, holding back on principle, that's a great way of becoming a new Republican Party or something. But I think to actually get voters and get people involved and interested, you need to do what Ron Paul did, pretty much. He definitely did not hold back. Yeah, say it the way it is, and don't hold back. I mean, bring home the troops. We're an empire. We shouldn't be an empire. Bring home the troops.
Right. Yeah.
It's easy. Everybody can understand it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, it's unfortunate the Libertarian Party has taken this kind of blue pilled. I had never heard this term actually until I watched a speech that Lou Rockwell gave not recently, but a while back, and he started calling them regime libertarians. It's something that I had never heard, and made it click so quickly because I'm a part of the Libertarian Party, and I'm dealing with these libertarians that are like, hey, we just want to get in the good graces of the DC elite, the Beltway elite, right? We don't really want to end all the wars. We just want to roll back what we can, you know. And it's like, that hasn't worked for this for a political party for 50 years. Why do you think it would work now when politics is at its most tribalistic in history, maybe in the United States ever? So I get it. It's time to be bold. And I think that, you know, the Mises Caucus is showing that being bold can bring people to your causes. Cause you know, 61% of the population didn't vote for a president in 2016. I mean, they don't want the two old parties. They don't want any of that crap anymore. They want bold, they want unapologetic. And so, I'm glad to hear you say it, even if I don't know if you take part in politics and all that stuff, but you know, here,
I stay away from such things, but I think they're immoral. True. I think people are really desperate for change, many of them. And talking to people, they hold their noses when they go to vote because the other side they think is worse. I mean, in that kind of world, don't try to be like the both sides. It should be pretty obvious. I mean, when people are upset, when people don't trust them, and when people must hold their noses to vote for the lesser evil, well, then you just offer the alternative. You stand tall and grow a spine and tell it like it is and offer the alternative. When your media might not want to touch you, but there are alternative media.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that I've talked a lot about on this show is, you know, anytime I'm a new podcaster, I started this show over a year ago as an audio show. I did 3 episodes, and then life happened. I couldn't do anymore. I decided to do a live show because it's like, if I do a live show and I make a schedule, I have to stick to it because I don't want to make people upset, you know. But people come to me and they're like, hey, you know, I kind of want to start a podcast, but isn't it like really oversaturated market? And I'm like, no, it's not for alternative media. I mean, it's oversaturated for the mainstream. I mean, for the corporate news media is what's oversaturated. You know, we need more shows. I mean, do it right. Bring the right people on, have a good show, do it right. Don't speak into a tin can, you know, make the audio good, but it's not oversaturated. We have not enough alternative media in this country. We don't, you know, maybe the world really. You know, so yeah, that's something I talk a lot about.
That's the simple entrepreneurship too. I mean, find your niche, find your business model, find what you're doing uniquely and that others value. Then, well, there you go.
Sure. I saw something in the chat that I want to talk. Oh yeah, I want to talk a little bit about this. I don't know where do you stand on Ayn Rand? So bad with names. Was that?
Do I stand on Ayn Rand?
don't stand on her. I mean, that's kind of weird. But I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about Yaron Brooks because someone posted it in the chat, and I wanted to see he's kind of, you know, I used to follow Yaron and I was a kind of a fan, but he like lately he's been like, you know, talking a lot of shit about anarchists and ANCAPs, and I'm like, what's going on here? And I think that's kind of the route that Rand took too, but. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to kind of drive that division. I mean, where do you stand on that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, it's been part of the objectivist movement to be anti-anarchist ever since Rand was exposed to, I guess, my Rothbard, right? So I know Yaron, and he's a good guy, and objectivists tend to be cut from the same cloth, all of them. They all look alike, they all talk alike, they all say the same things, but they have a very strong case, I think, morally for free enterprise and for entrepreneurship and for the economy and that sort of thing. I obviously don't agree with their view of government, and I don't agree with their view on IP and things like that. But I mean, they hate such things as the word libertarian, and they're not part of the libertarian movement, but they agree with almost everything. So it's a little odd. I consider them to be part of the statist libertarian movement.
Yeah, absolutely. It was funny because I'm glad someone posted that in chat. I have a friend an older gentleman at work that comes by my desk every once in a while, sits down and talks to me. He's watched the show a couple times. He's like, it's a pretty cool show. He comes today and he's like, hey, so what do you think about Ayn Rand? You know, and I'm like, oh, she hated my kind, man. She hated us. He's like, nah, she sounds so libertarian. She's a libertarian, right? I'm like, nah, she hated libertarians. She hated anarcho-capitalists. She hated Murray Rothbard. She didn't like any of that stuff. But, you know, they're like moral objectivists. So, you know, they have some good thoughts. But for the most part, you're not going to hear me singing the praises. She wrote some great books, though. You know, that's...
yeah, and I mean, it is what they say. It usually starts with Ayn Rand. And it does, right? I mean, few people in the libertarian movement broadly have reached as many people as Ayn Rand, and she did it in a really great way.
Sure. So I got one more question here. We're getting to the end of the public stream. We'll do this exclusive stream afterwards. We'll find something juicy to talk about. But a good friend of mine, David Hines, who's one of the founders of the Mises Caucus, extremely intelligent, very bright. The guy could definitely write for Mises. I mean, he's really, really good guy.
You're scaring me.
Yeah. But he wants to know how can praxeology, this is an easy question, but he wants it answered. How can praxeology, Austrian economics, empower the entrepreneur to make helpful business decisions? That's what we'll send it out there.
Yeah, that's something that I talk about a lot. And I think it's just the understanding that you get from Austrian economics helps you avoid errors. So one thing that I stress a lot is that I sort of already mentioned it, that you focus on value. So instead of, as many entrepreneurs do, unfortunately, they start with a product they want to produce, and they go, okay, so I want to sell this. How much does it cost to produce this thing? And then they add a price markup to it, and that's the price, and then they go to market. You should do it exactly the other way around. So first, try to figure out to whom would this type of thing be valuable, and what shape and form, and how valuable is it? So the value to the consumer should determine the price, because the price should be low enough to basically sell the product to the consumer. And then your job as an entrepreneur is to figure out how to produce this thing and make it available in that shape and form at a cost that is lower than the price. That's your job as an entrepreneur. Figure out what is valuable and then figure out how to produce it at the cost that gives you a profit. Right. So it's it's really about this basic understanding of the economy helps you think about things in the right way. That's where Austrian economics can help.
Sure, absolutely. We got one more super chat, and then we'll move on. Atlas, $5 super chat from Michael Ravel. Thank you, sir. He said, Atlas Shrugged was the first legit book I read as an adult. It sent me down a long road of reading. Much credit to Ayn. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very common story among libertarians and even ANCAPs.
It's common and it's important. Right? So, I mean, it influences a lot of people. It had a great impact on me, my thinking, too.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Per, I really appreciate you coming on, man. We're definitely going to have this exclusive chat for the members of the channel and patrons and all that stuff. But before you go, what do you got coming up? Is there anything you got going on that you can send people to? And where can they find you and support your work and stuff?
Well, the easiest way to find me is to go to Twitter, and my handle is Per Bylund. Or they can go to my website, which is perbylund.com. I try to take those. I mean, to Americans, it's sort of a really weird, unique kind of name, but it's not super uncommon in Sweden. So I need to be early and grab those domain names and everything like that. What have I got coming up? I mean, the biggest thing would be the primer, which should be out in December. And we're hoping to be able to sell it for just a few dollars. And of course, it's with the Mises Institute, so it's going to be available online. And if you want it in on dead trees, then you need to pay for it and shipping and that sort of thing. And in a couple of weeks, I'm giving a talk at the Free Market Medical Association. So there are plenty of events and stuff coming up too.
Nice, nice. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Per. If you just wait a couple minutes, I'll close out the show and then we'll get right into the exclusive chat. Thanks again. All right, guys. Per is absolutely based and much smarter than me. Just so you guys know, I'm very happy that you guys gave me questions to ask. I am going to go study way more of his work, and then maybe we'll bring him back on again sometime. But man, he's very intelligent. Go follow him. He's a great Twitter follower. I mean, one of the best Twitter follows I have, and I follow like 11,000 people or something. So that's a good one. Definitely check him out. Guys, I appreciate you checking us out. Let's check out the sponsors one more time. Lorenzotti.coffee for all your delicious Italian coffee needs delivered directly to your door. Bring the taste of Italy home. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. Of course, TopLobster.com, the man, the myth, the legend. Check him out. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount on great stuff like this Disobey Your Local Tyrant shirt I'm wearing today, or join the YouTube channel membership, Patreon, or Subscribestar, which are both / BreakTheCycleJS. If you'd like to get into the Discord server and get his stuff like 2 weeks early before it goes to general population at a 30% discount, it is well worth it, I promise you. He's got some great stuff right now, including a Joe Biden adrenochrome baby onesie so that you can get for your babies. Of course, executive producer of the show, anthemplanning.com. Check them out today. See what they can do for your business, home, or personal life. They're doing a wonderful job that the government sucks at, much cheaper and much more efficiently. Guys, coming up on the show tomorrow night, I'm going to have my good friend Karen Ann Harlos from the LNC, the secretary of the LNC, on tomorrow. We're going to talk about how much we hate the LNC and half the members on it, and all the drama that has taken place on the two terms we've served together. And then on Friday, the man himself, the president of the Mises Institute, Jeff Deist, will be on the show, and that's going to be a lot of fun. He's really, really happy about the graphic that Top Lobster drew for him, making him look like Bauer from 24. I'm sure he loves it. Anyways, guys, I appreciate you. Get those joins in. Join the exclusive chats with us every night. If you join the YouTube channel, you get to see them live. If you join the Patreon or the Subscribestar, you get to see them uploaded the next day with other swag, of course, if you join over there. I will see you guys tomorrow night for my show with my friend Karen Ann Harlos. But until then, don't forget to break the cycle. Okay, as soon as the outro's done, I'll start the other chat. You got anything juicy you want to talk about there? Or controversial?
Not hot dog.
No, we won't do that. We already did that with Tom. Chipper is my friend and he's constantly cold. Accusations of incitement getting totally old. Make your own choices, yeah, you have control. Because I just landed in Minecraft. Obviously I would never advocate force unless it's due process and a trial of
you a corpse in Minecraft, just in Minecraft. You're a nothing, I mean, you know it. No product in is getting close to COVID. Holy shit, I think I'm a poet.